Senator Thompson's right there. What's he here on?
Thompson. You're on.
Okay, let's call to order this meeting of the House Rules Committee. It's Thursday, June 9th. Welcome, everybody. We're going to start with a opening public hearing on Senate Bill 3. Invite Representative Gelser forward.
And, Mr. Chairman, we have Victoria Cox here who is going to give a little bit of a summary of the bill for you. And here she is.
Welcome back, Victoria.
Thank
How are you,
you sir. Great.
Back
much better.
Full health. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 3 modifies terminology in education statutes from mental retardation to intellectual disability for persons with intellectual disability, requires IEPs to use the terminology, authorizes Ledge Council to substitute intellectual disability wherever retardation or mental retardation occurs in ORS Chapters 326 to 353, declares an emergency and effective on passage.
Great. And let's also invite forward Libby Crawford. Are you Libby Crawford? If you want to come on forward with Representative Gelser, that'd be great. Representative Gelser, please proceed. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sarah Gelser, State Representative from House District 16 in Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for letting me come and visit you here today. I wanted to come and speak to you about Senate Bill 3, primarily to offer my gratitude to the Senate President, President Courtney, for taking the time to put this bill in. I think we all know that Senator Courtney has a history of really being a great advocate for those who experienced challenges and discrimination in life, and this is no exception to that record that he has developed. I would briefly want to explain that this issue may seem like it's a change in a word and may not impact educational outcomes, but I can tell you from experience that it can have a very direct relationship to how a student experiences their school day. Many of you know that I am the of a teenager who does experience an intellectual disability. And when we went to enroll him in kindergarten and went through the eligibility process, one of the eligibilities that was offered to us for him was trainably mentally retarded. As you might imagine, my husband and I were not quite willing to slap such a word on there. We tend to think of him and thought of him then as a bright, capable young boy to whom we would never apply a word like trainable, and certainly not the socially stigmatizing word retarded. If you fast forward to this past fall when he entered his freshman year of high school with the eligibility that we landed on for him, communication disorder, it caused a tremendous amount of confusion for the new, very large school staff that had to meet with him. As he walked into classrooms, they expected to meet a student who experienced a speech impediment. They did not recognize that they had a student coming to them that had a complex intellectual disability. Had we been able to give him a more respectful and appropriate eligibility category as a kindergartner, years later in high school, his transition would have been much more effective, and he would have had a much more productive couple of years in school. His school has launched this year, Spread the Word to End the Word. Probably many of you have seen this as people try to understand how damaging and hurtful the R word, retarded word, is, and I'm glad that we are looking at changing our statutes so that we can be respectful to our kids that very first day when they enter school. No parent should have to make that choice, and no one should be offered the option of calling their children those names. Happy to answer any question that you might have.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Please identify yourself and pull a mic a little bit closer and proceed.
Okay. I am Libby Crawford, so thank you, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, for having us and the rest of the committee. This is my daughter, Katie. I'd like to introduce her. She is also a freshman in high school. I want to kind of give you a little bit of background. In 2002, we were told that Katie could no longer attend the Christian school that her sister had been already involved with. And at first grade, they told us that she could go across the street to the public school and have some testing done and be put on their IEP process. We really didn't understand what they meant, but we agreed to it. She went through hours of testing in first grade, and they came back and said they absolutely could help my daughter, but that we would have to label her mentally retarded because she scored so high socially and in self-care. We were really taken aback by that and pretty much shocked, and we decided that we weren't going to label our daughter mentally retarded. What we did, what they did tell us was, well, don't worry about the label, and she can get Social Security insurance. And still, that was not important to us. So my husband and I said no to the label, And what we chose to do is to homeschool our daughter for the rest of the year, and we found a small school that was able to accommodate Katie's needs for education. She thrived in that school up until the first day of fourth grade when they had budget cuts and decided that she could not attend there anymore, and we were left again to try to find a school on the first day of September. So we were back into the public schools again. Again, they tested her, and again, they said to us that mental retarded was going to be her label. And we then had to accept that label against our better judgment. The shock and heartbreak to us came when we had to move her from elementary school to junior high. We selected a junior high that was highly recommended by our caseworker, who recommended a life skills class for Katie. And it was a self-contained class, very proactive with working with their IEP, individual education plan. And it was presented to us. The teacher was amazing. The children thrive in this classroom. And we finally felt like something was going to go our way. And on the first day of school, I went to school with Katie. I helped her find her locker, made sure she knew where she was going. And that's when it hit me. Life skills was not to help Katie. It was to contain Katie and other kids like Katie. And it's because of her label of mental retardation that she was on that track. It wasn't to help her blossom. It was basically a large daycare. It was the wrong class for Katie, and I spent the whole year fighting to get her into some regular ed classes, which never happened all of sixth grade. Instead, they let her clean the cafeteria after lunch as part of her regular ed. My heart dropped for every single child in that classroom that had the ability to do more but were not given the opportunity because of their label. We fought for a year to get her what she needed, and all the while they were testing her without our consent to keep her in that mentally retarded placement. It's hard for me to say those words because they come with a stigma that is not my daughter or anyone else's child. The word mentally retarded has no business in our educational system when describing these precious kids. As a parent, it is hard enough to know that your child's ability is not up to speed to their peers, but to have to label your child using such language is pretty devastating. We have kept this label from her until recently when we decided to go ahead with this bill and include her in this process. My daughter is now in mainstream classrooms with modifications and in two classes a day addressing her needs for extra help in math and reading. We had to sell the home of our dreams that we built to move into a school district that would accommodate that for her. This label also limits child's ability for hope, because when everyone sees this label, it sends a message that the child is limited in their capacity to learn. My family is lucky that we have the means to fight this fight and to feel that it has been our duty to fight for all families and to make this choice to label their child intellectual disabilities instead of the MR label. This label follows them for life. Therefore, we feel a change in the language has always been what is needed to truly identify where the struggle lies for each individual child. The term celebutard, or that was so retarded, is used too frequently by others in society. This referral insinuates being stupid, unintelligent, and dumb, none of which describe my daughter or any other child with her disability. I come to you today to ask for your help to do away with this language in our education system and change mentally retarded to intellectual disability when placing a child in their IEP.
And Mr. Chair, I apologize that I need to go to the other rules committee.
Okay, all right.
And I would like to ask your permission. My son, Thomas, would like to say something.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Thomas, why don't you come over to the other chair over there. Your kids are much better dressed than my children.
For today,
okay. Welcome, Thomas. If you could say your whole name into the mic, and then you can say whatever else you want to say.
Thomas Aubrey Crawford is my whole name. So what this means about Katie's bill is when she was in first grade, she got in the... I forgot the name, so that's something that happens. I just really want this bill to change. It's really mean to me that she can pass this if she does. It will be a new law, which is a really good law that I really like, and it's really good law that's really the best into our family. And everybody's hoping that every kid who's having this problem will get done with this and never have to be in the intellectual disability. So this is like a bill that I love.
All right. How old are you, Thomas?
6.
Wow. Okay.
Thank you.
Any questions for our witnesses here? Could I just ask, what school district did you end up in where you're getting good...
We moved to Tualatin Tiger. Okay. They have a full integration policy. So.
Great.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you all three for being here. Anyone else wanted to testify on this bill? Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 3 and open a work session on Senate Bill 3. Co-Chair Olson.
Chair Hunt, move Senate Bill 10, correction, Senate Bill 3 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 3 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's only one place that I can see what might be a substantive change in the law, other than this, the change of the words to intellectual disabilities, and that is on line 15, 16, and 17 on page 4. It may be that we're simply removing obsolete language, and I can't really tell.
Victoria, once again, Representative Barnhart throws you a curveball.
Representative Barnhart, my understanding is that it also allows legislative counsel to change this term anywhere it may appear currently or may appear in the future.
Thank you, and I recognize, Mr. Chair, I recognize that. What I'm referring to is the deletion of three lines at the end of Section 2 on page 4 that removes the language, implement programs for students with moderate to severe retardation under RS 343.236. In a manner that continues the pattern of services in neighborhood and community schools, which existed on July 1, 1985. Because of the way that's written, it looks like as though it might simply be
absolutely
a removal of obsolete language, but I don't know that. That's why I'm asking.
Victoria, you have a sense on that one?
I do not.
I'm going to put somebody on the spot. You have a legislative counsel right here.
The draft of that?
No. Mr. Chair, if Representative Gelser had not had to go to another meeting, I intended to ask her that question. I'm sure she knows the answer.
Anyone else have a comment about that? I think your reading is correct, that looks like, especially since it has a reference to 1985.
Right.
It does seem like that's obsolete, and LC just cleaned it up while they were in that section of the statute. Further discussion? Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Foley?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Yes.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. Co-Chair Hunt? Aye. Motion carries, and we'll ask Representative Gelser to carry this on the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 3. Okay, yeah, let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 10.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 10. You had this yesterday. It clarifies whether provisions that reference regular legislative session of Legislative Assembly apply to even-numbered or odd-numbered regular legislative sessions of Legislative Assembly. We waited on that because we heard that there may be a conflict with Senate Bill 800. You have Legislative Council here to explain that there is no conflict with SB 800. I'd like to have that explanation.
Just explained it.
Next, why don't you go ahead and come forward, just so we're
he's here.
Just so we're clear.
I think we got it. Representative Barnhart's had a chance to profess. We would like a chance to profess, or just briefly.
Just don't want to put him on the spot. Do you want to introduce yourself and say anything you want to say about Senate Bill 10?
Mr. Co-Chair, members, Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council, and... I'm basically just here to answer your questions. Senate Bill 10 is essentially a non-substantive bill. It, as you all know, voters amended the Constitution to require that the legislature meet annually, and this bill clarifies in existing law when it says regular session what that means, whether it's both sessions or the odd-numbered session, typically. So that's the purpose of the bill. I understand there's a question, as Jim mentioned, about a conflict with another bill, and with conflicts, kind of the way the system works, it will detect those, and the trailing bill will include a conflict amendment that will resolve the conflict.
Great. Representative Freeman did ask yesterday if there was any amendment to this he could propose that would actually overturn the constitutional provision at the heart of it.
Going back to just annual sessions or biannual sessions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Freeman, that would require a constitutional amendment.
May I profess for about 45 seconds?
Please.
The supposed conflict had to do with Senate Bill 800, which you passed. We went through this committee. That bill has an elimination of a statute in there, which is ORS 336.245. So it's kind of a classic conflict because that bill eliminates the ORS and this bill modifies it. So it turns out, though, that they have different effective dates. So this ORS 336.245 is going to be modified for about 3 months because of this bill, and then it'll be eliminated because of the other bill. The other bill was the one that eliminated a lot of requirements for educational institutions, as you recall.
Any additional questions for Dexter? Okay. Thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We are in a work session on Senate Bill 10.
Mr. Chair.
Co-Chair Olson.
Move Senate Bill 10 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Amy, please call the roll.
Yes.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Freeman? Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Motion carries, and would anyone really like to carry that on the floor? Representative Freeman?
I'm happy.
Yes.
Seriously?
He was?
All right. Representative Freeman will carry.
He's going to misrepresent what it does.
Stick to the text, Representative Freeman. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 10. Senator Thompson, are you here for Senate Bill 960? Okay. Let's move and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 960.
And, Mr. Chair, we have Beth Herzog to do the administration of that bill.
Welcome, Beth.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. Senate Bill 960 allows counties to authorize single agritourism or other commercial event or activity on attractive land zoned for exclusive farm use in a calendar year. It allows the county to use the expedited single event license to authorize an event on an EFU land in a calendar year, authorizes the county to authorize limited use permit for up to 6 events on attractive land zone for EFU, and it authorizes the county to authorize up to 18 commercial events or activities that occur more frequently or for longer periods of time that do not comply with the other permits described in the Act. It stipulates conditions on those authorizations. Stipulates that if a winery sited on EFU land conducts events authorized under the Act, the winery may not conduct events that are authorized by local government under ORS 215.452, the Permitted Use for Winery Statute. It establishes that the prevailing party in an action or claim for relief alleging nuisance or trespass arising from farming or forest practices not entitled to judgment for reasonable attorney fees and costs. If the party owns, operates, or attends an agritourism or commercial event authorized under the Act and claims arise from that event, it establishes that events authorized under the Act may be allowed on lands in designated urban and rural reserve, and establishes that the use or structure that exists on the effective date of the Act at a winery sited on EFU land that produces more than 250,000 gallons of wine in a calendar year 2010 may be lawfully continued, be altered, restored, or replaced.
Okay, great. Senator Thompson, do you want to come on up, and maybe Commissioner Stern and Arch Lack can come with you?
That was the abbreviated description.
Here's a bigger one. Oh, I wrote the thorn between two of them.
Yeah. Welcome to the Rules Committee. Please proceed.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, thanks for having me today. Chuck Thompson, Senate District 26. I first heard about the Farm Activities Bill when I was a county commissioner at our annual conference back in November. It was presented there. Talked to Art a little bit about it there. It was an interesting bill. Well, I got here for my first term, and a couple weeks into it, Art approached me and asked if I would like to sign on to the bill. I hadn't been involved with the process the year before, so I was new to that. I wasn't initially involved. About a week later, I realized, how come nobody else in this building signed their name? I'm thinking, I must be a really important person, but all of a sudden I'm going, wait, nobody else. I mean, everybody else is smart enough not to put their name on a land use bill. Because you can't please everybody with land use, and I know that. As a commissioner, don't we know that? Since that time, I'm proud that my name's on there, actually. I got involved, got asked to be on the work session, on the work group with that. It was very fought out, really back and forth. A lot of concessions, a lot of give and take on the Senate side, and I think they've done a very good job. Everybody did their due diligence, everybody was at the table, and it's here with you folks today. The best thing I can tell you about this as a state representative or senator, that this concept of the state not mandating something that every county has to do, they don't have to accept this if what is working in their county is working. So that's probably the best thing I can, the other good thing I can say about this bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Stern, welcome.
Chair Hunt and Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you for having us today. My name is Mary Stern. I'm a Yamhill County Commissioner, and I want to thank Senator Thompson for sponsoring this bill. We were glad that he wasn't aware of what happens with land use bills. Many counties were experiencing problems with activities on ag land for a few years now. There have been lots of issues. And then with the passage of Senate Bill 1055, there seemed to be more confusion. So there was a group of commissioners who wanted the Association of Oregon Counties to take this up, and we did. And I was appointed chair of the Farmland Activities Task Force. And I was warned about loading jackrabbits onto a flatbed truck, and having never seen a jackrabbit before, I wasn't afraid, but we had about 15 commissioners as committee members. We had representatives from the Farm Bureau and agency heads also participating. There was a large group. We also had many interested parties such as Wineries Association, restaurants, Thousand Friends of Oregon, a very diverse group. Everybody was heard, whether they were a member or just an interested party. Although everyone was heard, not everyone got their way, but we did move forward and create the recommendations from the Farmland Activities Task Force. And our goal was really to level the playing field for all types of agriculture, not just wineries, but we wanted to conserve farmland that we have in Oregon while also allowing landowners to get the most beneficial use from their property. We also wanted to clarify the county's authority. So what we came up with, Art is going to explain a little bit of that, and hope you like it.
Okay. Welcome.
Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, my name is Art Slack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties and had the pleasure of herding a bunch of wet cats. That was the Farmland Activities Task Force at this point. And I'm very happy to bring you basically the recommendations in the form of legislation at this point. As indicated, these amendments to ORS 215 and 213 are optional on the part of counties. These are not requirements, but a county may utilize these tools to permit events and activities in conjunction with farm use on farmland. The adoption of these provisions by counties is not required, as I indicated, by the passage of the bill. Counties simply have the option to utilize these provisions to help them consider with the permitting of events on farmland. One of the things that the that we found it as we looked at statute and administrative rules dealing with the management of activity or just all land use dealing with farmland, is there was a lack of clear authority to counties for the consideration of these types of activities, and as such, people were using some creative activities. Some counties were saying you can't do these. Other activities were just happening, and counties were faced with, so shall we say, some very unhappy neighbors and in terms of these activities taking place, and that they were not compatible not only with the neighborhood but also interfered with accepted farming practices that were that the farming community was trying to take place as part of their livelihood. The bill authorizes three separate pathways to obtain a permit to conduct activities on farmland. The first pathway is the authorization of a single event a year, this is based on some specific criteria. There is also an alternative to this one-time permit that provides basically for an administrative action. This is extremely specific. This type of permit, if you meet the criteria, which is specified in the bill, could be issued over the counter. But again, it's a one-time permit for in a calendar year. The second pathway is indicated by your summary at this point of the bill would authorize up to six events within a calendar year, and again, it's based on a set of standards and conditions. Would note that both the first and second pathways are, the permits are personal, so they're a little departure. This is something new in terms of land use. These are personal to the applicant, and if the property, they do not run with the land. If the land is sold, then the new owner would have to apply for a new permit at this point. The third pathway would authorize up to a maximum of 16 events, and this is very similar to a conditional use permit to authorize a multitude of agritourism or commercial events within a calendar year. This type of permit would run with the land, but I would note that there is a provision in the bill that it is reviewed, not renewed, but reviewed every 4 years at the request of the applicant. In all cases, the various pathways, the proposed events and activities have to be incidental and subordinate to the existing farm use on the tract of land at this point, and that they also comply with the provisions of ORS 215, 296, related to the impact of the proposal on agricultural operations in the area. They also have to comply with all applicable public health and safety requirements. So that is basically a very, I'll call it a brief review of the various pathways. We can answer questions if you'd like. The summary also talked about a couple of other pieces in the bill, the grandfather for, especially the grandfather for King Estates and maybe Willamette Winery based on large volumes at this point. So we'd be happy to answer questions. This is a good bill, Mr. Co-Chairs, and should pass.
All right. Questions for these witnesses? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at Section 6 on page 18. Is that the section you were just referring to, or is it something else?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, Section 6 on page 18 does provide the grandfather provision for large wineries. That is a winery that is in existence and that in 2010 had a production of 250,000 gallons of wine. They are, by the grandfather, would continue the uses and activities that had been ongoing at that wine at the date that this bill becomes law.
Thank you. And just to follow up,
sure.
Do we know how many wineries that's likely to apply to?
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, our understanding at this point that there are two that it would apply to, the King Estates in the Lane County area, and potentially also Willamette Winery in Marion County. I'm not aware of any others that have that volume of production in 2010.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Those are the two I would have thought of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, all three.
Thank you.
Thanks. Let's invite forward Alex, Patrick, and Sean. Always have them a blast.
Chair Hunt, Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau in support of Senate Bill 960. I won't get into more details than Mr. Schlack did regarding the bill. Only to express our support for the concept. I believe that the bill as drafted will actually provide more opportunities for Oregon farming families to help ends meet when times are lean. I also think that there are some very important provisions within the bill that help to preserve farmland at a greater level than is currently allowed through some of the creative provisions that Mr. Schlack talked about in his testimony for citing certain activities. We feel that the parameters given around all three levels of activities are appropriate. I do want to point out for the record that nothing in this bill would interfere with seasonal type events such as a pumpkin patch. Those are permitted either through farm stand provisions or commercial activities in conjunction with farm use. What we're talking about in these bills are a variety of smaller activities that could be just about anything as long as they are subordinate to the production on the farm. There is flexibility for counties under the bill that we think is an appropriate level of government interaction, and it's my hope that this bill will provide a relief valve for future legislation that would be drafted to include another specific use in our EFU statute. So this is a slightly better way, more flexible for counties, and again, that relief valve for new bills to be introduced to this process. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you. So, either one.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, Patrick Caffer with the Oregon Association of Nurseries, here to lend our support to the bill as well. It's an issue that cuts both ways with my members, as we have members that want to make sure that there aren't large events clear or close to their land, but there's also a number of members that we have that want to continue to be able to do the events that they have. I think that this bill strikes a good balance, and it's we're able to support it. I think it works in a way that can make all of our members happy. So we appreciate all the hard work that's gone into the bill, and Senator Thompson's sponsorship of the bill, and we urge your support. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Alex, welcome.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I think you have in front of you a testimony today from Lane County. The Board of County Commissioners has expressed their support for Senate Bill 960. This is an issue in terms of providing for a structure, a regulatory framework around especially events at wineries that we've been dealing with in Lane County since at least 2003. And it sort of culminated in 2008 with a final push to provide a way to bring all wineries into compliance. Probably the toughest issue we faced was permitting the restaurant at King Estate. And really at the 11th hour of finalizing that permit, the issue was appealed to the building official, and that sits now
sort of in recess as the legislature finalizes its work on this measure, and we're eager to see that come to a conclusion through the passage of this bill. Lane County's territorial highway is sort of our destination in Lane County for wineries. We've got a number of wineries along that road. It's been designated as a scenic byway, and we've actually entered into negotiations with the state of Oregon to do a swap for that road, so that Lane County can obtain authority to have ownership of the road and seek improvements better than can be sought under ODOT's authority. So it's an area that is we see as has a real future in terms of economic development for Lane County. We would love to have as many people come and visit the wineries there as possible and enjoy the many events. What we're seeking is the consistent regulatory framework, and as you've heard in the testimony, this bill provides that framework in a flexible manner, but one that will be consistent statewide. So thank you.
Great. Questions for any of these three? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since the senator from District 4 voted for this measure in the Senate, I am assuming this bill will have no effect on the country fair.
I would agree with you.
Thank you.
Everything has effect on the country fair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, all three.
Thank you.
And the wrap-up panel, Dan Jarman, Phil Donovan. And if anyone else wanted to testify and did not show up, this would be your chance to come on up.
If you did not sign up,
what did I say? Oh, yes. If you did not sign up and you want to testify, you may come up. Welcome. Phil, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. Phil Donovan here on behalf of King State Winery. Very briefly, just want to say that we greatly appreciate the participation and the work group that helped put together this legislation. We put together, on behalf of King Estate and Wine Valley Vineyards, a very tightly crafted but elegant solution to the restaurant that were in operation at King Estate Winery. And so with that, we would ask you to pass the bill as is. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Dan?
Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, my name is Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. We have been working with the county's organization as well as Farm Bureau and other stakeholders on these issues for a number of months. At one point, interestingly enough, we were sort of tied together in this bill. The winery portions of that is no longer in this legislation. It's in a bill that will most likely be in a conference committee in the coming days, and that bill is House Bill 3280. So I know that I've met with many of you individually to talk about sort of the winery portions of that bill, and we'll have more to say later on about that. And certainly would appreciate the support of the legislature to work on that piece of legislation. Even though this legislation would affect grape growers, the wineries, as you know, have their own statute, 215-452, that governs those activities and events in farmlands. That only deals with permitted use wineries. So any grape growers that are doing activities certainly would fall under this legislation. And since we are the Wine Growers Association, wineries and grape growers, this certainly does affect many of our members. I would point out just one thing. There is, at some point, I guess, possibly, the possible need for conflict amendments. The bill, as it is drafted now, in 960, would basically say that if you're a winery and you wanted to seek authority for events and you went through this pathway in this legislation, you are then prevented from going either the conditional use pathway or through the winery siting statute for events. Our legislation actually does something a little differently. It basically would require wineries to go through the winery siting statute for events. So at some point, if both of these measures are moving, that is one area where there would be direct conflict and we'd have to get that resolved. That certainly is a conversation, I guess, for another day and perhaps in the conference committee, but I just wanted to point that out to the members that there is just one difference between our legislation and this legislation in front of you today. Thank you, and I'm very happy to answer any questions.
Great. Questions for these folks? all questions answered.
Thank
all
you,
right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you both very much. Not seeing anyone. Do you want to wait for the work session, or do you want to say something now?
I'd like to ask a question of Art Schlack.
Okay. Art, actually, if you'd be willing to come on back, Rips and Fulby has a follow-up for you.
We've been told others that there's no...
Go ahead, Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was trying to find this in the bill. And I know there are common language definitions, but I was looking to see if there actually was a definition of incidental and subordinate in reference to the section about the on page 9. And I was just curious whether what the consensus is of what is meant by that, what are incidental and subordinate to the existing commercial farm use.
Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Hovey, that language is not defined. It has been used in conjunction with other activities in the past, so it's kind of cribbed. There is some history. Certainly it is less than 50%, but I, at this point, do not. There is not a clear definition of incidental and subordinate. So that's the best I can help you with at this point.
Less than 50% of the uses?
Less than 50% of the income.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Art?
Okay.
Thanks for coming back.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 960 and open a work session on Senate Bill 960. Coach Olson.
Chair Hunt, move Senate Bill 960 to the House floor with the due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves Senate Bill 960A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Seeing none, Amy, please call the roll.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Gary?
Aye.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Excuse.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Colby, would you be game for carrying this one?
Sure.
Representative Barnhart will buy the wine and you can carry the bill.
Closed for sure then.
Bring the cheese. You'll bring the cheese. Very good.
Too late, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 960. Yeah, actually, was anyone here to testify on HJM 28, the Hanford resolution, HJM 28? Okay. We are planning, I just wanted to let you know, we've got some language amendments being made to that bill, so we're not going to be hearing that today. Hopefully it will be coming back in the next period of time. Whatever period of time that may be. So, let's see. Why don't we move and open a public hearing on House Bill 3690.
Chairman, this is House Bill 3690. It specifies a time period, that is 18 months or a date specified in a contract, for a health insurer to request refund of paid claim, and specifies the time period for a health care provider to request additional payment and to resubmit the claim denied by or refunded to a different insurer. I should mention that Sandy Teeley Circa is going to be the administrator on this. I am substituting for Sandy Teeley Circa today.
Okay, great. Yeah. Brian Rose, at least come on down. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you. Co-Chair Hunt, Co-Chair Olson, members of the Rules Committee. My name is Brian Behringer, and I'm the Government Affairs Person for the Oregon Medical Association. Thanks for hearing our bill today. You have our written testimony being passed out to you, so I'm just going to briefly summarize. This bill, House Bill 3690, has had a long trek through the Legislative Assembly, and we are here today with consensus language on an issue that we've been working on for some time. This bill deals with the very exciting prospect of overpayment recovery. It's a bill that we passed last session, Senate Bill 508, which put some timelines around how long an insurer has to seek overpayment to a physician or a clinic, and how long physicians have to seek underpayment from those insurers. And those timelines were fiercely negotiated last session into 24-month allotments. Inadvertently last session, we created a problem that we call a timely filing problem by accidentally omitting some language. The issue with timely filing is, for example, a patient could come in and hand his physician a insurance card, and unknowing to them, they may have just, their work may have just changed insurance plans, there might be a family change, and so that physician bills that insurer, and then they seek the insurer comes back and determines that it's not them, and they seek the overpayment, and then if it's in a contract that the timeline's already been passed, then that physician is out of luck trying to seek that payment. So we sought to include this session some timely filing language and it included a new timeline of 24 months. And so that started a negotiation between the insurers and the ASCs and OMA to find the perfect number for that timely filing, which we arrived at 12 months. And to get that agreement where I think everybody was in a fair place, we adjusted the overpayment for insurers seeking refunds from 24 down to 18, and we also adjusted the timeline for physicians seeking underpayment from insurers from 24 down to 18. Why are we here? When we reached that agreement, past some of the legislative deadlines, the agreement was too large to fit into the relating to clause of the bill we had available to us. And so we are now here with a new bill, hoping to get this through the process. So really quickly to recap, the language that we have consensus on in front of you today is a consensus agreement between AHIP, OMA, and OASCA. The concepts in this agreement have had public hearings in the Senate and the House, even though this is a new bill. The concepts in this agreement were passed in the Senate about a month ago, and the reason we missed the deadlines is because of the relating to clause. So with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
Chairman Hunt. My name is Rose Cox, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. I think Brian did an excellent job of describing the road we've been down so far and where we're trying to go, and I would just like to reiterate that the Ambulatory Surgery Centers are very happy with this language, and we appreciate how much work the OMA and the insurers have put into this with us, and we absolutely support this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown representing AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and our members on the ground here in Oregon who all collaborated with OMA on the new language include Regents, Kaiser, Providence Health Plan, ODS, HealthNet, and Pacific Source. So you've got everybody. We are happy with the language, and we're here to support it today. We hope you move it along. Thanks.
Questions for these witnesses? Let me just ask to make sure, is in your ideal world, would we have a work session on this bill when?
Mr. Chair, we are seeking several paths to the governor's office. While we would certainly appreciate you hearing this right now, we may have, because of the timelines, have a better path that will get us there faster. And so we'd love it if you would hold this over while we make sure that that is available to us. If it is, then this bill can sit, and we certainly don't want to waste your time with it. But if we end up back here, we need this as sort of our last resort.
But one other option you may want to think about is, at least as we get up to tomorrow, because we are meeting tomorrow, one option would be that we send it out tomorrow, so because it can always be pulled back from the floor, but there's just a number of days it's going to have to work through to get to the floor. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We will do that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I may,
Rose, you bet.
You may also see a Senate bill coming your way with exactly the same language but in a different vehicle, so don't be surprised if we come back before you with that. It's just the end of the session time, so thank you.
Yep. Yeah, we know the dynamics in certain parts of the building with bills going to certain committees that are closed. Okay.
Thank you
very much. Appreciate you being here. Anyone else wanted to testify on House Bill 3690? Close the public hearing on House Bill 3690. We will potentially be back to that tomorrow. And to wrap up, open a public hearing on House Bill 3691.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this is House Bill 3691. This exempts manufacturers of athletic products from the definition of athlete agent. It requires athlete agents to notify the athlete's educational institution before initiating contact with student athletes. It limits the definition of student athlete to individuals attending school in Oregon. It makes violation an unlawful trade practice subject to prosecution by the Attorney General or District Attorney. It directs prosecuting attorneys to give consideration to the need for uniformity among the states that have enacted the Uniform Athletic Agents Act. You have an amendment, -1, that amends that modifies the definition of agency contract to include provision that the agreement would make the student athlete ineligible to compete due to violation of state or national athletic association rules.
And half of the people who testified today have been wearing green, so you prepared us well for this bill. Welcome to the Rules Committee.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and members of the committee. I really appreciate it. I'm humbled to be here today. I don't often get a chance to speak before such a board. But my name is Jeff Hawkins. I'm the Director of Football Operations at the University of Oregon since 2001. I also have a title as Senior Associate Athletic Director for Football Administration Operations. To give you a little bit of my background, I also serve as Chairman of the Executive DFO Committee, which is a national committee under the umbrella of the American Football Coaches Association, and a member of a national committee comprised of the NFL, the NFLPA, the NCAA, the AFCA, and also agents. I've worked on every level of football, 3-2, 1-AA, 1-pro, semi-pro, you name it. My job is to oversee the overall administration of a Division I football team, and with that I work very closely with Bill Clever and other members of our compliance to make sure that we navigate through the NCAA rules, which change sometimes without notice and change often. I've been involved with Bill for the past, better part of the past decade, dealing with athlete agents. 6 years ago, Coach Grant Taft, who's executive director of the AFCA, the American Football Coaches Association, appointed me as this national chair. And first and foremost, our biggest issue when we meet twice a year, the directors of football operations, is to make sure we create agent oversight. And we're woefully behind in that. The principal topic year in and year out is agent education. It's not a new issue. The directors of football operations wake up every day dealing with this, but most other people seem to think that it's fairly new, and it's not. Last September, after a summer that was full of public scandals involving colleges and universities and unscrupulous agent activity, I was asked to serve on another committee, which I mentioned, with the NFLPA, the NFL, and NCAA, by Rachel Newman Baker, who is in charge of agent gambling and amateurism. I was the only DFO in the country that was on this committee. I was the only university that was on this committee. There were high-ranking members of every one of those organizations at the highest level. To have all these entities to sit down at the same table at one time is historically unprecedented. Some of the people came to the table willingly, some didn't come willingly, but all have something at stake. The American Football Coaches Association, its membership, which are college football coaches, high school football coaches, won't have to worry about outside influences on their team's performance and their school's integrity. The NCAA will be able to continue to maintain high standards of amateurism. The NFLPA will have assistance in regulating its actions and oversights of agents. And the NFL can continue to reap the rewards from the current model that they benefit from, which is low or no-cost product development. And for the agents, it creates a level and fair playing field. And for the student-athlete, it provides a support system that will allow us to help the student-athletes and their families to make informed decisions. And for the states, it will regulate an industry that has run roughshod over their laws for years and will create revenue through revenue, fees, and fines to provide funding for ongoing criminal investigations. But all you have to do is prosecute this one time. Ironically, or more tragically, in the current collapse of the collective bargaining agreement between the NFL and the NFLPA, what's happened is the NFLPA has decertified itself. So now that means nobody is minding the store. So now the agents have no oversight while the NFLPA is decertified. The only ones that have any laws that are against this now are the state and the federals. And right now they're running roughshod. And I repeat, nobody is overseeing this. At Oregon, in the past 2 months alone, we've had two situations at the University of Oregon where we've had two freshmen who have been contacted by agents. That's against state law. That's against NCAA rules. It's against the NFLPA rules. But they made contact with these kids, and they shouldn't have. And luckily, these kids are educated enough that they come to us. It's extremely important to make sure that everybody realizes that the branch of government that oversees this law has to have the authority and the resources to pursue individuals who are not compliant. Right now it's the Department of Education. And that person, Deborah Lincoln, is in charge of doing background checks on school bus drivers. Do they really have the resources to follow this? I want to thank Senator Pina Courtney and the legislators for keeping this in the eye, because this is not going to go away. But we have to get it right. Ultimately, the whole thing revolves around the same thing, the enforcement of federal and state laws, NCAA, NFLPA rules. Regulation, registration, enforcement, education, and support. The good news is the University of Oregon has provided institutional control and is way ahead of the curve among our peers regarding education and student-athlete. In fact, we instruct other universities how to do this. Since 2007, we've taken it a step further, allowance with NCAA rules, to provide a sports paneling council, okay, comprised of individually selected by the athletes, so when the opportunity comes within the calendar that they sit down to interview agents, we're next to them. They have got the questions that we've helped put together, you know, how many people do you represent, and all the different types of questions, which I've given you a copy of our team rules, which has those questions involved in there, so they can make informed decisions. But what we do is we do background check, making sure that they're signed, registered with the state, make sure that they're certified by the NFLPA, making sure they're in good standing. So we do the background checks, but our players make all the decisions. Like all other states, though, the problem is 43 states have the UAAA. Nobody is enforcing it. And the rules are broken all the time. And laws are broken all the time. And NCAA rules, you know, there probably are 1,500 to 2,000 recruiting rules that are broken every year. And what happens is a student athlete gets caught or a coach gets caught, then the NCAA enforces it. Unfortunately, when this law is broken in the state, nothing is done about it. Not only in Oregon, but nowhere is it being happening. Our educational process is further supplemented by bringing on-campus throughout the year by entities who come onto our campus and share the realities, both the upside and the downside of playing in the NFL. The term agent has been around since the beginning of civilization. Webster defines it as someone who is authorized to act for in place of another representative, emissary, or government official. It also says someone who engages in undercover activities, as many of these sports agents do. Ultimately, if anyone serves as a manager, a mediator, a representative, or a negotiator on someone, they're an agent. At some point in time, everybody needs an agent. Right now, I'm trying to sell my house. I have a realty agent. So everybody needs someone to help with the root of the issue that they're dealing with. But there lies the root of the problem that exists in college sports, the ever-increasingly in high school, the definition of what an agent is. The National Football League Players Association, the Players Union, recognizes the contract advisor as the agent. The NCAA's definition of an agent is much broader and incorporates all third parties who work in the shadows of campuses, of high schools and colleges, as what's commonly known as a runner. Our definition, the definition that we want to put into law, is any person who represents or seeks to represent, directly or indirectly, and seeks to receive consideration or the promise of consideration with an amateur student athlete in the marketing of his or her athletics ability or reputation. We're not trying to stop these people from operating. All we're trying to do is make sure that the people who fall under the definition don't fail to register with the state, pay a fee, register with a high school or college so that they're on the radar so we can monitor what they're doing. Understand this, and this is crucial. They sometimes interchangeably refer to themselves as contract advisors, financial planners, marketing reps, insurance brokers, trainers, mentors, advisors, consultants, counselors, former players, teachers, guides, tutors, coaches, confidence, spiritual advisors, Dutch uncles, kibitzers, yada, yada, yada. What they often say is, don't call me, I'm not an agent. But that's what they try to hide out from, that I'm not what the NFLPA calls me, I'm not what the NFL calls me. I'm not an agent. But if they seek to represent or to gain profit, you're an agent. And there lies a lot of the problem that we have across this country. Simply speaking, if they're making a buck off of it, they're an agent. Sports agents have been around since the turn of the century. And a part of the reason why the NCAA came into view was because of the unscrupulous activities of agents. I'm not sure if you know your football history, but Red Grange was somebody who was, you know, a lot of athletes were playing both ways. They were playing college sports and pro sports at the same time. That's the formation of the NCAA was put in. In the 60s, when the NFL salaries started to escalate and endorsement contracts started coming into being, that's when you heard about all these super agents that started coming around. Finally, when the public had had enough, elected officials were forced to enact laws that would regulate and punish agents. On the federal level, it was Sparta. On the state level, it was the UAAA. And to date, 43 states have it on their books. We passed ours in 2000. No one has enforced it. Texas just recently came out and said they have passed the toughest law in the nation. But to date, they haven't prosecuted anybody. To date, virtually no one has done it. In fact, not lost in the situation that existed in North Carolina last summer when 14 Tar Heel football players were declared ineligible and one coach was fired for illegal benefits and impermissible contact with student athletes, with agents. Last September, Bill Polian, who is the president of the Indianapolis Colts, called me. He's on this committee I'm on. And he said, how can I convince Andrew Cuomo, the Attorney General of New York, to take his resources towards this when they have all these other problems going on in New York? And my response to him was, I bet you the Attorney General in North Carolina said the same thing a month ago. But they weren't proactive. They were all being reactive at this point. The NCAA oversees student athletes, coaches, and administration. They have no subpoena powers whatsoever. The currently decertified NFLPA oversees agents, in other words, the contract advisors and financial planners, but they have no jurisdiction over the other people, the third-party people, at all. Current NFL players dictate much of the policies that their union exercises, and their focus pretty much revolves around salaries and working conditions. Punishing their agents for misconduct is not within their purview. It remains for the state and federal government to protect its citizens, who in this case happen to be student-athletes. Currently, there are 850 certified agents that are certified by the Players Union. Only half of those people have a client. And half of these agents reside in the state of California. Realize this, that if an agent goes through a three-year cycle where they don't have a client, they become decertified. So what happens during that third-year cycle is they start panicking and they start doing things that are unscrupulous and doing things wrong. And make no mistake about it, most, if not all of them, cheat to some degree. There are many issues, but the primary one that I bring up here is the very definition of an agent. But essentially, again, if they seek to represent or to gain financially, they're an agent. It's not apples and apples, it's oranges and oranges. We're not proposing the toughest law. We're proposing the most comprehensive law. Defining an athlete agent, defining an agreement, defining a calendar of contact, much like the NFL, the NCAA dictates that college coaches have to do, in making sure our student athletes are not preyed upon, but educating them to make good decisions. It's not about the University of Oregon. It's about the state of Oregon. It's not about Oregon football players. It's about every student athlete in the state at every level, elementary, high school, and college. One of the biggest penalties the NCAA will level against a college university is the charge of lack of institutional control. By virtue of me sitting here and talking to you, I can share with you that what Oregon does and what we share with everybody as far as what we do here, I can't see how we can ever be accused of a lack of institutional control. However, I can see how states can be accused of that because they're not enforcing the laws in the books. If you look what happened to USC and to North Carolina, and you look what's happening to Ohio State right now, then I can go back and look at the legislators of California, North Carolina, and Ohio and say, you have only yourselves to blame for this. I don't want Oregon to join that crowd. We can fix this before it gets too late. I want you guys to help. Any questions?
Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. While you've been talking, I've been looking up the statute, in which I think is the Uniform Athlete Agents Act, which I think is in Chapter 702. Of the Oregon Revised Statutes, if I ever understood what you're describing correctly.
Yes.
I have a concern about the way this thing is set up, and I just want to make sure I understand it. In the very first part of the bill, Section 1, lines 8, 9, and then the amendment, you would add to the current definition, describes an agreement with a student-athlete authorizes a person negotiator or consult or solicit on behalf of a student-athlete a professional sports service contract, an endorsement contract, or an endorsement contract. Then you've changed that. Oh, I see. Now I think I'm getting it as I look at this. Or another agreement that would make the student ineligible to participate in interscholastic or intercollegiate sport because of a violation of rules or regulations established by a state or national organization that governs student-athlete eligibility or participation. Okay, so as I understand it, now that I've parsed it again,
yes, sir.
These are three different definitions of the term agency contract.
Well,
the third one being the actionable one.
Yes, you know, and the key here is that they're getting more and more creative.
Right. May I, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I have no problem with the concept. Okay. What I'm looking at now is the language. I want to make certain that I understand it.
Yes, sir.
Then most of the rest of the bill is really just a comment, if I may. Line 28, 29 of page 1. Educational institution means public or private elementary school. You have agents who go to elementary schools?
Right now, they're in the high schools. It's only a matter of time before they go.
Okay, and then, of course, the rest of it, secondary school, community college, university, other educational institution. You covered the waterfront.
Yeah.
Section 3. This is one that I'm really worried about, Mr. Chair, because of the way it's written. Before initiating contact, this is the one that requires the agent to make a contact, a written notice to the educational institution. It doesn't say how that notice is to be made. Is it defined somewhere else in the law as to how a notice is to be given? To the educational institution. University of Oregon is a big place.
Right.
Does that mean I have to, if I'm an agent, I have to give it to the president? I have to give it to the athletic director? I could give it to a dorm resident counselor? What does it mean?
You're absolutely correct, because this has changed a little bit from when we gave it over to have it been put down in print.
Right.
And compliance office, every single NCAA school in the country has a compliance office regarding of what their resources are. They all have, so compliance office would be the way that would go through. So I can see where
it
the wording bothers you.
The reason I'm concerned, Mr. Chair, is it doesn't say that.
Yes, sir.
It just says written notice to the educational institution in which the student athlete is enrolled. That's it. And it has to be delivered by electronic mail, facsimile, or other electronic means. If I have the name and address or name and email address of a dorm counselor,
I agree.
Does that suffice?
No, you're absolutely right. I totally agree with you.
All right.
I think we have tightened that up.
Thank you. And then finally, Mr. Chair, if I may, you've added this to the Unfair Trade Practices Act on line 11, page 5. I've been scrambling to look at the sections that's about, and it appears to be about the need to register, the requirement that there be no fraud or misrepresentation made to the athlete, provisions having to do with withdrawal from the contract, things of that kind. So, Mr. Chair, it seems to me that if, given the timing, if this issue were to move to the Senate, if we were to pass it out and it passed, I would suspect that our witness here would want to propose an amendment in the Senate that would tighten up this notice requirement. Otherwise, I'm fine with it.
Okay. Helpful. Other questions for Jeff? Okay, we appreciate you coming up. Your duck calls are very subtle, as opposed to some of my colleagues.
I truly appreciate the opportunity to sit before you folks today. This is something I have a real passion over that you can probably pick up on, and it's because of my players who get taken advantage of.
So are you comfortable with the approach that Representative Barnhart outlined of sending it over to the Senate and fixing it over there?
I don't know the process. I have to lean on you folks, but I'm willing to do whatever to get this accomplished, and with the right verbiage, because I agree with you. You know, some of this has changed a little bit as it crosses hands.
Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd be perfectly happy to help, but I would need the university to give us the language so that we get it right.
I'm at your disposal.
Thank you.
Representative Holden.
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if we could ask if, while they're doing amendments, if we could make this retroactive in the state of Alabama as well.
We've been sitting by Representative Freeman too long, I think.
That I hadn't thought about.
We're getting a lot of publicity. I've been asked to write a 1,000-word article for the American Football Coaches within this month. And it would please me very much so to be able to say what Oregon has done and fly this up the pole and let the rest of the states jump on board.
Representative Berger.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I would like for Oregon to be a leader in this. Normally, I am very hesitant to send anything out of a committee that needs an amendment in the Senate. This is one of those rules that I don't like to break. The session time is getting short, and I think I might make an exception here if it is put on the record, specifically in talking points on the floor, that this is language that needs to be added to the bill. Great. I'm comfortable with that.
And I would suggest that you start working with our committee staff and maybe Representative Barnhart, if you're willing to be involved in that a little bit, to actually start drafting the amendment now.
Yes.
So by the time it arrives in the Senate, it's already got an amendment queued up.
I'll do whatever I have to
okay.
do.
That will cost the fewest number of days, or hours, as the case may be. Right.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I may, that's exactly the concern I had. This looks like something that can't wait, and I know that when the Senate adjourns, it's adjourned.
There were some things I would respectfully like to defer to you in the verbiage to make sure that it tightens up. I think probably even more would satisfy you even more.
Thank you.
So maybe if the two of you could connect even right after this hearing with Jim and Amy.
Better do it this afternoon.
Yeah, like literally right after this, right after we recess. So that would be great. Good. Thanks for coming up, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you all.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 3691 and open a work session on House Bill 3691. Colleagues, we do have a -1 amendment before us that was not related to the amendment Representative Barnhart was talking about. Was a fix that Jim explained earlier. Co-Chair Olson.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments into House Bill 3691.
Co-Chair Olson moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 3691. Discussion? Any objection? Incorporate the -1s. Co-Chair Olson.
Chair Hunt, I move House Bill 3691 as amended to the House floor with due pass recommendation.
Co-Chair Olson moves House Bill 3691 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Amy, please call the roll.
Representative
Berger?
Aye.
Representative Bannon? Aye. Representative Garrett? Excused.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger? Excused.
Representative
Barnhart? Aye. Co-Chair Olson? Aye. Co-Chair Hunt? Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Barnhart, you game for sharing that on the floor, and then you can get the statement on the record.
Working on the amendments and satisfying Representative Berger's comment about statement on the record. Thank you.
Perfect. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3691. And Jim, we're slated to meet, is it at 2:30 tomorrow?
We're going to be at 12:30 tomorrow.
12:30 on Friday.
12:30 to 12:45?
We've got just a couple. Yeah. Quick.
Yeah,
so, great. We are adjourned. See you tomorrow.
That's my family.
Did you move? It's 10:30.